Finance and Revenue is open. Good morning, everyone. We're going to start off with Senate Bill 807 today. Senator Roblin and Representative McEwen are here. We'll get a staff briefing first if you guys want to make your way up.
Can we bring our
hospital? Yeah, bring your team up.
You can have the middle.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 807 is a bill the committee heard briefly on the 28th, but it allows a health district that does not impose, assess, levy, or otherwise collect taxes on property within the territory of the district to invest in securities.
That was a brief.
It's a very brief bill.
Yeah.
Very simple bill.
Okay. Well, we'll let you guys take a swing at the problem we're trying to address here with this legislation.
Thank you, Chair Haas. Members of the committee, my name is Kati McEwen. I represent House District 9, Coos Bay to Yahats and into almost Elmira. We brought this bill today on behalf of Bay Area Hospital. In the 70s, a very well-respected group of community leaders came together and formed an organization to combine two aging hospital facilities in our community. And they built an amazing facility called Bay Area Hospital, which persists to this day and does great service to our community. It's a regional hospital. It serves a significant area of the South Coast. But it operates under some rather unique set of rules. And they are coming here today to ask for the same consideration that Oregon Health and Sciences University does and our public university system does in the way they handle their investments. Senator Roblin has been involved in this. Paul Yonke is the president of the Bay Area Hospital and the CEO of the hospital and is here today to explain the details of why they're asking for this ability to handle their investments differently, but in the same way that some other organizations in this state do. So I'll turn it over to Senator Roblin.
So when I met with the hospital staff a few months ago, this was one of the things that came up, and I talked with some of the board members as well. It is one of the only, if not the only, large hospital in Oregon that is publicly owned by the people of our community. So most of the others are either private, state-owned like OHSU and others, but we have a hospital district. It has the ability to charge taxes. It has a tax base. It's never chosen to use that, so it's never used the tax base. They have been exceedingly fiscally responsible over the number of years that they've been in existence, including building new buildings, adding wings, doing the kinds of things that upgraded a cancer center. They've been working with our local people to have a Hope Center, which works with abused kids and on their campus. They have done a lot of things to improve the health and well-being of our community, foundation of which I'm on the board, giving away grants to others. And they've done that by just running a hospital exceedingly well. They are conservative in their approaches to different kinds of things, but when they saw both the university system and OHSU having the ability to invest differently, they said, could we invest in it? We won't ever use, and if we ever use public money, i.e. bring money in through a tax base, we understand at that point we should never invest that in risky kinds of things at all. But we believe that knowing the people who are running the hospital, we could invest and get a bigger return on that investment outside of the constraints that are on those hospitals, and therefore continue to build a reserve that can allow us to build the new buildings that we need, do the staffing that we want, and all of those things. So it seemed like a simple little request. Didn't realize that there's some constitutional issues and other kinds of things with respect to these public entities being able to do that. And that's why we've had the number of bills that we've had with OHSU and the university system to get them there. Didn't think that we would have to do all of that, but the more I've seen, the more that I recognize there will be a need for another amendment that would identify this particular place as having the ability to go outside of those kinds of rules. But the simple thing is, we wanted to have a conversation about how a local hospital, which has done all the things they can right for our community, could in fact be able to take advantage of some of the same things we've offered some of the larger institutions in our state, and make sure that we do it right. So that's why it's here in front of you, and I'll let our CEO of the hospital, Mr. Yonke, have a hit at that explanation, and if we need to go back to the drawing board with some an amendment that does that, I just wanted to get a feel for this committee and whether they think that's something that we should consider or not.
I'd like to add just one more thing, Chair Haas, members of the committee. Also, for 40 years, this hospital district has provided remarkable, exemplary service to the citizens of our community. They've invested, as Arnie mentioned, in expansions. They just added a new cardiac center. They've added a new cancer treatment wing. And they've done that because they've managed their money well. And in our community, they are very, very, very well respected because of the conservative nature in the way that they handle their finances, and they invest in things because they've managed it well, not because they've gone to the voters and asked for help. So they have the full respect of our community, and I think that's an important thing to note.
And my final thing about the same thing. We do have a mental health unit at our hospital. It's a very expensive one. It loses money all the time because they stay there longer than we think they should. We can't find a place to put them. But it is a community investment, knowing that it's one of the only places. They were instrumental in our CCO and its involvement and got involved in the CCO from the very beginning. And so it is trying to figure out how to make that all work. And as a personal note, it was a place where I got to do infusion therapy for 28 days after I had an infected hip this last year. So having an infusion therapy, having an infusion wing right there was really nice for my wife, who was not hoping to have to do this on her own with me. And I say that because it really has looked out and tried to meet the needs of community everywhere it could, and has been able to do that without asking people for money from the tax base and just handling their business well. So with that, I'll turn it over to and you could ask questions for us. Both of us have committees that are going right now, so I've got to get to Ways and Means, and Kathy's got one that she has to
transportation.
So any questions for us before? Yeah, exactly.
Thank you, Senator.
You're starting the morning bad already for me.
Thanks. We'll keep chewing on this bone here,
okay,
and let you get back to work, okay?
Thank
okay.
you, Senator.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Have a great time.
And thank
Thanks,
you, Bill.
Bro.
So, yeah, I think the – can I go ahead?
Yeah, give us your overview. I'd also be interested in how much money we're talking about and what you're doing with that money now.
And a name to start with.
Yeah, and I think that's a very important starting place. So what we're really asking for, first of all, just a little bit more. So Bay Area Hospital is a full service.
Start off with your name and ID. And
yeah, my name is Paul Yonke. I'm the president and chief executive officer of Bay Area Hospital, Coos Bay, Oregon. Bay Area Hospital is part of the Bay Area Health District. It's really the operating element of Bay Area Health District. We're a full-service medical center servicing the whole Southern Oregon coast area. We offer a range of services comparable to many of the medical centers on the I-5 corridor, Portland through Salem, through down through Medford. We are organized, being a health district, like 14 other health districts in the state. But as Senator Roblin pointed out, we're the only health district that does not and has not since the 1980s had any kind of an operating or capital levy. The board and the governance of the health district has long chosen to be conservative and not take advantage of any ability to levy a local tax. So we've been financially able to make it on our own. And we're the only health district, to my knowledge, that's in that place. The healthcare world is a very competitive world, and to make it as an independent, and we're trying to be a strong independent healthcare organization. We believe that being in control of our destiny is important. We need to be on a level playing field with the other major medical centers in Oregon, and we are currently the only medical center that is precluded from investing in equities. All of the others, including the governmental entity, which would be OHSU, have the latitude to invest in equities. We are only able to invest in fixed income instruments. So we would like to have that latitude The way the health district Oregon administrative statute and rules are written, we're not able to do that. So that's the very simple request that we have. Now, I'm aware just since the last couple days that there's been this issue about the constitutionality of this as it relates to the fact that we're a municipal corporation as compared to apparently OHSU is defined as a public corporation. So I think we would like to be given a chance to try to modify the language of the bill to address that issue. Hopefully we can do that. But again, on a go-forward basis, in a very competitive healthcare world, we feel like we need this latitude, and that's the reason for the bill. We're not asking for 1 cent. We don't need any money. It's more a matter of how we invest our investment portfolio. That is what the request relates to, and that's the only reason that we're asking for it. So can I answer any questions? Does that make sense?
Well, I don't know if you can answer the questions, but we can ask some. Senator Boquist?
I had a question of staff first, and then I'd like to get his answer here, right? Because obviously we're talking about, you know, the mythical widgets are running around behind the scenes that have not testified yet, are saying this is unconstitutional and legislative council must have said it's unconstitutional. And I've heard a vicious rumor that it might be the treasurer's office. So can staff tell us, you know, is there some question?
We have some other people signed up to testify.
Do we?
You want to just wait?
I will wait, but I mean, I do have one simple question. Can you come up with one logical reason why you're the only one left out of the system?
Because we've emerged as a major organization in Oregon. We're defined as what's called a DRG hospital. We're one of 26, 27 larger medical centers in Oregon. All of the other health districts are much smaller. I think they're all critical access hospitals. They're just much more limited in scope. So they use their local taxing authority. The major medical centers on the I-5 corridor, they're larger, they're not for profit, or they're for profit, and they're not saddled with this restriction because they're either non-governmental, or in the case of OHSU, some years ago there was legislation that was created that defined them as a public corporation and made an exception.
Okay, thank you.
You were going to tell us how much money you were talking about.
Well, we're talking about $0 because we're not asking for any dollars.
I know that, but when you invest, is it tens of millions? Is it 50,000?
Oh, sure. So we're actually, as Oregon medical centers go, we're not huge. We have an operating base of about $180 million a year. We have an investment portfolio related to our funded depreciation of about $60 million a year. And it's that $60 million where we only invest in fixed income instruments. And it would be nice to have the latitude. Even in seeking this authority, we're going to be conservative in the way we do this.
Question, Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Hass. So just to clarify, just make sure the public understands, so you're wanting to buy stocks, you're wanting to have this, and I assume you want to take a little more risk in order to have a higher profit. Correct?
Yes.
Okay. And so, you know, if things did not go well, or there, you know, a lot of folks talking about a market corrections right around the corner, et cetera, and so I think we just wanted to have an understanding, or at least I'd like to have an understanding, of what percentage of your portfolio you're envisioning spending on that, and then if something were to go terribly wrong with the market, how would you make up for that loss? And would you be needing state assistance if something were to go terribly wrong with the market? At least that's what I'm trying to understand.
Yeah. I think the flexibility we're requesting is a long-term request. As you've pointed out, the market right now, you know, I mean, the market's always going to have its ups and downs. And right now, my sense would be we'd be pretty conservative as we've always been. But there could well be points in the future where we'd want to. We're not seeking any financial support. In fact, there's really no mechanism for us to get any financial support beyond the current way we get paid for services, which is through payers or through billings directly to patients. So we're not asking for any support. And we're going to continue to be conservative investors in the way that we manage our investment portfolio.
Question, Senator Bertschinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you are a special taxing district, correct?
Correct.
So you have the ability to put on a ballot or your board to raise revenue for the hospital, if you wanted to?
We do.
Wouldn't it be possible then that you could raise the revenue and then take those dollars and invest them in securities or other things?
Well, actually, the way this legislation has been structured, it only applies to health districts that do not seek any local taxing authority. So if for whatever reason we wanted to have local taxing authority, then we would not be able to invest in equities. That's the way this legislation reads. We're saying that, yeah, if we are not taking advantage of that local taxing authority, because we don't want the local community to bear the risk of those investment decisions if we made those.
Why don't we call up Cynthia Burns and ask her some of these questions and get into some of the issues that have come up, okay?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Chair Hess, I apologize. I didn't have time to sign up. My name is Cheryl Heemstra. I'm with the Department of Justice and the Deputy Legislative Director.
Yeah.
So, Chair Hass, members of the committee, Cheryl Heemstra, Deputy Legislative Director for the Attorney General at the Department of Justice. As you know, bills go through both chambers and then up to the governor's desk and then come over to the Department of Justice for a constitutional review. There we look at the bill not on policy issues or anything like that, just to make sure the bill passes constitutionality, as we would be the ones defending it in court if that issue came up. So we like to flag constitutional issues at this point in the game before we get to that level. Ms. Burns here is our expert in this area and is with me today to answer any of these questions. I think the main issue here is that under Article 11, Section 9, any municipal corporations aren't allowed to make these investments. So it's a matter of how the entity is defined. And so we're concerned from a constitutional standpoint. We're neutral on the policy, and it sounds like the hospital is doing great work, but just wanted to make sure that this gets past that review, and we're happy to sit down with stakeholders. We've been reaching out to Senator Roblin's office to discuss the issue. So.
Okay. It sounds like that work is underway. This can be fixed, what they want to do. Do you think that's possible?
Chair Haas, members of the committee, I'm Cynthia Burns from the Attorney General's office. The issue is sort of the unclear status that revolves around public corporations and municipal corporations. The Constitution says that no county, city, town, or municipal corporation can invest in stock. And when the courts have looked at municipal corporations or public corporations like SAFE and OHSU, they've basically declined to say what those are. Instead, they sort of go issue by issue and say, well, we don't really know what they are, but for purposes of this issue, we're going to decide that they are part of the state, they are governmental, they can take advantage of this statutory provision or exemption or whatever, and have sort of declined to rule on a blanket basis in terms of things that are called a public corporation or a municipal corporation, to what extent they are or are not on a global scheme sort of outside the constitutional purview or other issues. So for something like this, a municipal corporation has attributes of governmental powers and duties. So the line that you're walking is how many of those governmental attributes do you have to sort of take away before the court would just say this is not a municipal corporation within the meaning of that provision of the Constitution? And there isn't a lot of great guidance on how much you have to take away. So, the bottom line is if there are amendments to the bill that take away a number of governmental functions and it comes back through DOJ, we would probably say, well, we think it's constitutional, but there's a risk that the issue's never been decided by the courts.
Okay. Questions, Senator Boquist?
Do we have a legislative council here? Sure.
We don't. And, you know, rather than, I think, get into a maddening discussion on constitutionality here, it might be better just to let these people talk it over and see if there's a fix.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist.
You know, I think that the fundamental issue here is, I mean, I'm involved in other areas the Department of Justice is in, and of course, I find it just ironic that, you know, what we really have is the Department of Justice claiming, and the Attorney General claiming that legislative counsel drafted an unconstitutional piece of legislation or potentially unconstitutional. And this is the second hearing we sort of have here. And I only raise this issue because it is center and forefront in several of the other areas we have right now. And I've actually sat in the room with competing lawyers with the Department of Justice arguing, frankly, against each other. So I would hope that in the future that the Attorney General will have the common courtesy to go to legislative counsel and try and resolve these issues beforehand and not show up in the committee room on the second hearing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Riley.
Thank you. So does OHSU have a levy?
Chair Haas, Senator Riley, I don't know for certain. I don't think they have the ability to levy taxes, but I don't know for sure.
OHSU, the way it's organized, is not a health taxing district, so it wouldn't have a permanent authority or something to that effect.
Great, thank you.
So, Chair, I just have one question. Thank you, Chair Haas. So, would this problem be solved if the hospital got rid of its ability to levy taxes? Would this become a moot point?
Chair Haas, Senator Taylor, I'm not certain. They have a number of governmental attributes. They have the power to exercise eminent domain, and that's a pretty key governmental function. Okay. They deposit their funds in qualified depositories in Oregon, as other public officials do. They have to follow right now the investment statutes for public entities. So, you know, they have defined boundaries. I think their boards of directors are elected by the people in the district. So they have a number of other sort of governmental attributes besides just the ability to levy a tax.
All right. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Close public hearing on Senate Bill 807, and I think we have some people here interested in these next two. I will open a public hearing on both Senate Bill 202 and Senate Bill 840. Kyle, could you give us an overview?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 202 and 840, both, the way they're similar to each other is they both do deal with public right-of-ways and cities' oversight of them and ability to essentially charge fees and privilege taxes and the such related to them. But so Senate Bill 202, it prohibits a city from imposing upon any public body, local government, or a local service district a license fee, a privilege tax, a rent, or any other charge that's associated with the city's right-of-ways in an amount that exceeds the city's actual costs that are directly related to administering the use for which that license fee, privilege tax, or rent is charged, so the use of the right-of-way. It is limited to apply to charges that are first imposed on or after the effective date of the act, so it's not retroactive. That's Senate Bill 202. Senate Bill 840, It starts off by articulating some different legislative assembly findings and declarations related to public right-of-ways. So it's changing some of those declarations that's in statute today. It does establish limits of privilege taxes imposed upon cities, upon utilities for the purpose of using those right-of-ways. The limit equals 5% of the gross revenues of the communication service provider earned within the boundaries of the municipality. It does provide under some circumstances for the initial year when the privilege taxes may exceed 5% in some circumstances. In instances where a utility is a unit of a local government, it does limit the city to charging the fee or the tax at the actual cost. So that's similar to Senate Bill 202. And then also included is a specification for utility, city, or third party to possibly be required to pay the relocation costs of a facility of the utility. and it does make modifications to the types of communication services on which the municipalities may impose these privileged taxes or public right-of-way taxes and fees.
We're going to start off with the proponents of this bill. Mark Landauer, you want to come up? Do you have a team? Or
yeah, if I may, thank you.
Yeah.
Good morning, Chair Haas, members of the committee. My name is Mark Landauer. I'm here on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Our association represents approximately 950 districts, providing a variety of services to the citizens of Oregon. I've asked that Mr. Brooks join me this morning. He has argued a number of these cases before a number of the courts, and I'd like to provide you a little bit of the legal background of this issue, and then I'll make a few concluding remarks. So thank you.
Good morning, Chair Haas, members of the committee. My name is Tommy Brooks. I'm with the law firm Cable Houston in Portland. In testifying in support of Senate Bill 202. As Mark mentioned, I've had the opportunity to represent a number of public entity clients, largely special districts, around this issue of franchise fees and privileged taxes and their use of the right-of-way, which a lot of times is embodied in the statute. Sometimes it's just inherent in the nature of the work that they do. My testimony and appearance this morning aren't on behalf of any specific client, but rather to give you my perspective as a practitioner that advises these clients to give them some certainty about how they move forward and navigate these statutes. Specifically, I want to share with you what we know and what we don't know about this area of the law, and a lot of that is informed by the legislative record. These kinds of fees have been around for quite some time. It's also informed by nearly a century of case law. There's been fights about intergovernmental charges for quite some time. I had a chance recently to review a copy of a letter from Legislative Council that addresses a lot of these issues. I hope that gets put into the record. So some of what I have to say mirrors that, and I'm happy to read that letter because it makes me more confident in what I'm about to share with you. The first thing we know is that cities do have home rule authority to govern quite broadly and to regulate within their territorial jurisdictions. That authority is at its broadest when the entity being regulated is a private entity. But that authority is not unbounded, and there are limits on the regulation of other public entities. The second thing we definitely know is that that authority that comes with that home rule authority includes regulating the right-of-way. And regulating the right-of-way also includes even being able to impose a charge to compensate the city for overseeing that regulation, essentially for implementing that program, whatever it is. This was the central tenet that came out of the Rogue Valley case. This is Rogue Valley versus Sanitary Services versus the City of Phoenix. And there the city had imposed what they called a privilege tax, but the Supreme Court determined was a regulatory fee. And the city in that case had put into the record kind of a litany of their costs of supervising the right-of-way, going to make sure that things were put back into place, maybe issuing permits if there was kind of traffic control issues. And that had resulted in a figure that they calculated was about 5% of Rogue Valley's income in the city. And based on that feature of it, that it was recovering the city's costs and not being used for general fund revenue, the Supreme Court said that kind of fee is okay. That's inherent within what a city can do, and that doesn't infringe on the right of the sanitary authority, even though they have a right to be in the right-of-way under the statute. The third thing that we know for sure is that home rule authority does not include the authority for a city to tax another public entity. And that's what came out of the Northwest Natural versus Gresham case. These two cases almost happened at the same time. They were kind of pending at the Court of Appeals near each other, but came out a few months apart out of the Supreme Court. But the reason we can be confident in the holding of that case is because that case involved two investor-owned utilities, PGE and Northwest Natural, and one special district. In this case, it was the Rockwood Water PUD, which is a public entity. And the city was imposing the exact same charge of 7% on all of those utilities. And the court said that with respect to the investor-owned utilities, that charge was perfectly fine, 7%, even though the statute limits privileged taxes to 5%, that extra increment against the investor-owned utilities was within the authority of the city to do under its home rule authority. But that exact same charge as applied to Rockwood Water PUD was determined to be unlawful because, as the court said, you need express statutory authority in order to impose a tax by one governmental entity against another. And so only with respect to Rockwood Water PUD, the court said you can't impose anything more than what the statute has allowed you to. The one thing that I've picked up from kind of all of this history is what the rationale behind that that default position against intergovernmental taxation is. And this came from two cases in the late 20s and in 1930 in Portland involving the city and the county fighting each other. And the courts were pretty clear that when you have overlapping constituencies, there's a tax by one of the entities over another is actually a net detriment instead of a net gain, because the same people who are paying the tax are going to receive the tax, only it costs money to levy and collect the tax, so overall you weren't gaining anything. And that's why the court said that if you want to have a tax like that, you've got to get permission from the legislature, because it must be a pretty special circumstance. That was followed up in 1930 with another case where I think the best image that the courts have gone with is that intergovernmental taxation is just taking money out of one pocket and putting it to another. And that's what that's how the court has since described it. What Senate Bill 202 does is start to address that second point of how cities regulate the right-of-way and charge to recover the cost of that regulation. And it puts a little flesh on that bone, which is important to give the special districts the comfort and security of knowing what they're going to be responsible for in the coming years. One of the most important things that these small districts do is establish rates. They're the ones that send the bill to the customers. They're the ones that have to collect it. And they have to make sure that those rates recover all of their charges. The only way that they can do that prudently is to be able to know what those charges are going to be. So if they know what their capital plan is for the next coming years, they know what the impact on the city is going to be. They know that the city might be able to collect those charges. They can make that part of their overall cost, and then they have rates that they know are going to be pretty steady. So what Senate Bill 202 does is clearly state that it's the actual cost that a city incurs that it can charge against these other public entities. The reason I say that addresses one of the unknowns is so far the case law only involves these two types of entities, sanitary authorities and PUDs. But we know from the holdings of the court that it's still a broad proposition that these are the kinds of fees that cities are limited to. So rather than litigate this question every time, you know, if a city calls it a privilege tax or they call it a fee or they call it some other charge, the point is to make them whole and to put some sideboards on what it is that makes them whole. And I think that'll give a lot of certainty to a lot of these special districts and make things go a lot smoother over the coming years. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Bircher, you want to go back to the hospital bill?
Yeah. I just want some clarity in this. So what I'm understanding is that one government entity cannot tax another government entity. However, one government entity can levy assessments for services provided to another government entity.
Chair Haas and Senator Bircher, the fee for services is kind of actually in a wholly different world. There's all sorts of intergovernmental agreements where one entity provides a service to another and gets a fee for that service, and they essentially contractually determine what that fee is worth. If it's not worth it, then they won't enter into that deal. Regulation is a slightly more refined version of that, where it's more one-sided, where the city says you can be in the right-of-way and you can be in these places, but you have to do X, Y, and Z to repair the street, and they would be able to collect the charge for administering that kind of program, and the court has approved that.
Okay, we'll get you to stand down for now and go through some of this testimony that we have signed up for and against.
Very good. If I may just add a few more comments, Chair, and I realize you have a full group here to testify.
I thought you completed your presentation.
Yeah, forgive me. I do have a rather lengthy one, and I'll just skip it and just get to the heart of the matter. For the special districts, we have absolutely no quibble with the cities about recovering charges. We do that as special districts, water districts, sewer districts, so on and so forth. However, we do have a fundamental problem of using one governmental entity as a proxy or surrogate to raise general fund revenues for another governmental entity. That's really the heart of the matter in this bill. We have a couple of examples, and you'll hear some testimony shortly, that really makes you have to scratch your head as to whether or not a city is actually recovering actual costs or, in fact, lining their general fund pocket. For us, that is a problem. We recently found out about an example where a city is now considering literally a tax on a rural fire district based on the number of employees that work for that fire district. I cannot, for the life of me, understand how a rural fire district imposes costs on a city based on the number of employees that fire district employs. This is becoming a bit absurd, and we are simply asking for guidance by the legislature on this issue, so as Mr. Brooks mentioned, we don't have to continue to have court battles on this matter, and just allow us to have some certainty in the future. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you, and we do have your documents in the record on behalf of the analyst. I'm going to kind of go back and forth here between opponents and proponents here, and so let me call up Craig Honeyman, Mayor Denny Doyle, Sean O'Day.
Chair Hass and members of the committee, good morning. My name is Craig Honeyman. I'm speaking today on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. We represent all 241 cities in Oregon. Many of those cities are represented in the audience behind me, and several others have submitted testimony for the record. My purpose today is to briefly tee up what you're going to hear from our witnesses. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's not an exaggeration to say that Senate Bill 202 and Senate Bill 840 turn upside down existing law and relationships between cities and those providing critical energy, water, and communication services to local citizens. Consequently, the League of Cities and cities throughout Oregon are emphatically opposed to both of these bills, and this morning you're going to hear why. Let me briefly summarize some of the messages and themes you will hear in subsequent testimony. First of all, Oregon is a home rule state, meaning that local control is paramount to cities in Oregon. Local authority in regards to rights-of-way management and the receipt of fair and reasonable compensation for the occupancy of local rights-of-way being held in public trust by cities has been upheld by the courts every step of the way. In addition, this legislation creates some ambiguity as to the ability of cities to charge themselves internally franchise fees. The negative impact of both of these bills, especially Senate Bill 840, is second is on a revenue source that is second only to property taxes, is enormous. Especially in the case of Senate Bill 202, This is about local issues being addressed locally. Local issues, local solutions, and you're going to hear more about that from Washington County cities in a moment. Cities are forward providers of these services with a very efficient, relatively inexpensive, and linear means of accessing rights of way, providing them with a single source, i.e. a city, for gaining that access, as opposed to having to negotiate with a myriad number of individual property owners. This discussion, members of the committee, needs to be about taxpayer fairness as well as ratepayer fairness. Finally, please note that cities need the energy, the water, and the communication services provided by the occupants of their rights of way. So it is not in a city's interest to charge usurious fees, and I would submit to you that they do not. So those are some of the messages you're going to hear about this this morning, that, and I wanted to underscore in my testimony. Thank you for the opportunity to make our case for preserving local authority to manage these very important public assets. And if I might, Mr. Chair, I'd like to call on Sean O'Day of the League to discuss further some of the legal and judicial backgrounds in these bills.
Okay. If you can keep your brief.
I will. Good morning, Chair Haas, Vice Chair Boquist. I'm Sean O'Day. I'm the General Counsel for the League of Oregon Cities. As already been stated, Oregon is a home rule state. Often that gets put forward without much explanation as to what that means. And to fully understand home rule really requires an understanding of what home rule is not. In other parts of the country, Oregon is just but a handful of states that follows the rule of home rule. Other states follow what's called Dillon's Rule, which means that a city needs legislative authority in which to act. Oregon actually began as a Dillon's Rule state until 1906, when the voters of Oregon put the Home Rule Amendment into the Oregon Constitution, thereby vesting authority in the voters of every community to adopt a Home Rule charter, vesting in their city council the government authority that stands independent from the state. Many of the statutes that we're talking about today existed at the time that the 1906 amendments were adopted and would have been needed in order for a non-home rule city to take action, to charge fees, and to regulate their rights of way. However, today, all 241 cities in the state of Oregon have adopted a home rule charter. By our records, Westford was the last in 1997. For 150 years, cities have retained ownership and control over their rights of way. What these two bills attempt to do, as Mr. Honeyman indicated, is turn that precedent on its head. Rather than giving cities the authority to manage and own and to provide for the residents of their community, and up to including the point of excluding others from the right-of-way, what these bills do is they grant a right that previously Oregon law has not recognized. And to be certain, right-of-way is perhaps the single largest real estate holding that a city has. And with that, the cities have a fiduciary duty to manage that right-of-way for the benefit of all of the community's residents. Now, although we don't have a case in Oregon on point, we do have cases in other states where property held by a government entity, namely the state, that is held in trust for the benefit of all public, includes a legal requirement to maximize the revenues from that property for the benefit of all citizens. Specifically, if any of you are familiar with school trust lands in the state of Oregon, such a requirement exists and came along with the federal grant of those properties. As Mr. Honeyman said, these bills attempt to overrule existing precedent. And I respectfully disagree with Mr. Brooks' view of the cases, and it's a position with which we are both comfortable, as we've both argued the alternative sides of all of the cases that he mentioned, mostly in our case as an amicus before the Oregon Supreme Court. What this bill would do, again, is give the right, purportedly give the right to occupy versus giving cities the right to manage the right-of-way. It caps franchise fees to 5%, where no cap currently exists. It would cap franchise fees to public entities using the right-of-way to just their actual cost. And I submit to you that this is an overruling, an attempted overruling, of the City of Phoenix case. What the court held in the City of Phoenix was that the fee that the City of Phoenix was charging was not a tax, and therefore the court didn't spend any further time trying to analyze the intergovernmental taxation issue that was otherwise present in the case. And what the court then looked at was the legislative history of the statutes before you, looked at the home rule status of the city, and said that the city of Phoenix was allowed, lawfully allowed as a home rule entity to receive compensation for the use of that right-of-way. The court, although the city put forth an argument that its form of compensation was just to recover its costs, the court's holding was not so limited. The court said that as a home rule entity, that city got to have compensation for use of this public asset. This bill would shift relocation costs to cities and others, effectively attempting to overrule Northwest Natural v. Portland and Urban Renewal versus Pacific Northwest Bell. This bill would also attempt to override the Northwest Natural v. Gresham case, another case that Mr. Brooks spoke to. And let me be clear, Gresham did not hold that cities cannot tax special districts. You have to read that case very carefully. What that case was about was whether or not the city of Gresham could impose a privilege tax of 7% on both public and private utilities. With respect to the public utility, the city had said, we understand that there's a legal principle that when it comes to intergovernmental taxation, a city must point to, or one government must point to, statutory authority for that tax. And in that case, the city put forth, they thought they had that statutory authority, and the court disagreed. The court said, no, Gresham, with respect to that particular statute, we don't think that gives you the authority to tax. There was also a second issue in that case, and that was whether or not, as a home rule entity, the city nonetheless, under its home rule authority, could impose a tax. And to that question, the court said it was not going to reach that question or decide it because of the way in which it was briefed. Specifically, Gresham had referenced the league's brief in the City of Phoenix case on that issue, and the court said that's not a proper way in which to brief these issues, and so we're not going to decide it, thereby leaving open the question in the state of Oregon of whether or not a home rule entity can impose a privilege tax on another government entity. And again, this bill purports to close that and answer that question. In addition, this bill would repeal a very important piece of Oregon law, of Oregon statute, that says that home, that what these statutes do is actually affirm the right of home rule authorities, home rule cities, to charge compensation for use of their rights of way. So although it may be submitted to you that what this bill does is attempt to codify existing case law, I will tell you it does exactly the opposite. It is an attempt to override the case law and take out of state law those statutory provisions upon which those case holdings were held. As someone who successfully defended the rights of home rule cities and on behalf of my members, I ask that you not take any action on this bill. This area of the law is complex, and as the second largest source of revenue for many municipalities, taking away a city's ability to receive just compensation for use of its right-of-way will likely engender litigation. Moreover, this bill, as Mayor Doyle is about to explain, is simply bad policy. And I'm happy to answer questions that you may have with regard to the cases that both Mr. Brooks and I have raised.
Okay. Mayor Doyle.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair House and Vice Chair Boquist and members of the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue. Thanks for the opportunity to talk a little bit this morning. For the record, I am still Denny Doyle, the mayor of the city of Beaverton, and currently serve as the board president for the League of Oregon Cities. In both capacities, I strongly urge you to oppose Senate Bill 202 and Senate Bill 840 that are before you today. At the heart of both bills is an attack on the city's right to manage its right-of-way that would reverse decades of legislative and judicial decisions affirming local control of a local asset. There's only so much space in a right-of-way, and those that want to use it for their purposes, public or private, need to pay for the use of the local asset, as well as repair it when newer relocated utilities damage it. I'll touch just briefly on both bills. SB 202 would preempt a city from charging other public entities the same right-of-way fee that it charges all others, including the city's own departments. In fact, Beaverton's own utilities, including water, sanitary, sewer, and storm utilities, have paid 5% to the city for the use of the right-of-way for more than two decades. Beaverton is not asking other public utilities who rely on our right-of-way to do more than the city requires of itself. I'm also pleased to share that several Washington County cities, including Beaverton, recently passed right-of-way ordinances that apply uniform right-of-way fees to all utilities in the right-of-way. In Beaverton, the right-of-way fee is 5% of gross revenues earned within the city. Beaver worked closely with its special district partners like Clean Water Services, Tuolumne Valley Water District, to ensure that the right-of-way fees enacted throughout Washington County were implemented in a fair, consistent manner and addressed each partner's need for predictable revenues and payments. Just yesterday, the Washington County Board of Commissioners, on behalf of Clean Water Services, adopted a voluntary agreement between local partners to implement the right-of-way fees adopted by cities. SB 202 is a one-size-fits-all state preemption that undermines our ability to manage local issues locally. Our experience in Washington County demonstrates that local government partners are in the best position to understand local issues and develop solutions that meet local needs and benefit at the same time the entire region. SB 840 contains the provisions of SB 202 but adds other preemptions, more dramatically reversing a city's home rule authority to manage reasonable access to its right-of-way relative to special district and private service utilities. The right-of-way is Beaverton's largest asset, and the city manages it for all of its residents, who have invested millions of dollars in public funds to build and continue to invest to maintain the right-of-way. Historically, Beaverton granted individual negotiated franchises to the utilities in the right-of-way, but the city recently determined that it could more effectively and fairly manage the right-of-way through licenses rather than franchise. Licenses standardize the terms of right-of-way use and eliminate legal fees and staff for both the city and the utilities. The city also hired a public works management analyst to oversee right-of-way issues and provide utilities with a single point of contact and a high level of customer service. Beaverton is really serious about proactively managing its right-of-way because right-of-way fees are the city's second largest source of revenue. Our residents depend on the services provided by the utilities in our right-of-way. The physical space in the right-of-way is increasingly more crowded and is a primary cause for the right-of-way's early and excessive deterioration, is frequently excavations by utilities who occupy the right-of-way. Before Beaverton passed its ordinance, we conducted extensive outreach to impacted utilities and made several revisions of the ordinance after receiving utility comments. That process is ongoing. This is where these discussions need to happen and are happening at the local level between the parties involved. Beaverton has responsibly used its home rule authority to manage the city's largest resource. Our management is consistent with our duty to protect our residents' extraordinary investment in the right-of-way, and the city's home rule authority to manage its right-of-way has been upheld in the courts and in the legislature for decades. In conclusion, there are many technical aspects to Senate Bill 202 and 840, which others that follow this panel will share with you. But simply put, they are both our sweeping attempts to preempt local control of a local asset when there is no statewide urgency to do so. The collaboration among cities in Washington County with our special districts, our utilities, clearly demonstrates issues related to right-of-way management are best resolved locally. Senate Bill 202 and 840 would directly and significantly impact local budgets, compromise public health and safety, and lead to protracted litigation. So please oppose these sweeping and draconian bills, and thank you. And I guess we're here to answer questions or let people smarter than me come up and talk.
Thank you. I guess the question is, and I don't want to oversimplify this, but we heard from our first panel say that really the heart of the matter here is paying what's necessary to recover costs, and it appears that nobody has any issue with that, the utilities or the special districts. But at what point do they get or need or deserve protection from going beyond that? And that's really, I think, where there's a place for something. So any ideas on how they get that insurance or assurance that it doesn't go beyond what's appropriate for that, that be outside of this legislation?
Well, Chair Haas, members of the committee, I think that one of the key components here is to understand that this is a real estate holding for which the city manages and charges essentially rent for its use, and charges rent at what amounts to a market rate. That certainly, you know, many special districts, I believe, I'm not a special district's attorney, have the power of condemnation. If they were needing, they could acquire the same real estate interest on their own. I would expect it probably at substantial cost, that beyond which what the cities are charging. Otherwise, they would economically make that choice to do that or attempt to negotiate with property owners for an easement. So I think the question here is certainly, you know, we're not looking We're not looking for cities to be able to take advantage of a situation with other government entities. What cities truly are doing here is attempting to charge a just and reasonable compensation, just as if it was renting out a public building. I don't think that the residents of that community would be very pleased if that city was renting it out just at cost. I think that the reasonable expectation of the residents of that community would be that that city would charge a rate that was equal to a just compensation. And
but that, devil's advocate on that, if it was a public building, the rent was too high, somebody could move.
Sure.
Utility doesn't have that choice.
I think I would ask some of the utilities whether they have the power of eminent domain and the power to condemn right-of-way, in which they would have that choice.
Okay. Senator Boquist?
Just an observation. I mean, two things that jump out. I mean, if I went and asked any member of 90% of the cities in my district, and I went and asked any of the citizens, and they thought that, you know, the city, county, state, any public entity should be taxing each other, and they'd absolutely say no. I mean, the reality of this situation is you know, we have this intergovernmental taxation, and the reason it's such a big revenue source, let's just cut to the chase here, is that because we have 5 and 50, and there's restrictions on other abilities to raise revenue. So the cities don't have any choice but to try and go raise revenues back and forth. That's really the fundamental issue. It's not really this issue right here. If cities normally, mayor, had the taxing authority and the things and a lot of the compression things we had, and you could actually run it without it, I have a suspicion that most of the cities would work, as the good director said, in cooperation with the special districts or water district or sewer, and come up with ways to solve this. But the problem is the cities are going broke, okay, and you got to have a revenue source. That's really the fundamental issue here. And this is much more complex than just this bill. It goes back to 5 and 50 and basic governmental funding. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions for this panel? All right, thank you. Thank you. Thanks for coming down. We do have a lot of people to go through. We're going to shut down here shortly before 10 o'clock. So in order to get everyone through here, I hope you'll appreciate the need to be brief. We're not going to set up a timer, although I have one. We're not going to do that yet.
I'll run it for you.
Okay. Chris Story and Craig Geis from Clackamas County.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is Greg Geist. I am the Director of Water and Environment Services. We're a department of Clackamas County, and we serve over 165,000 people in Clackamas County, and we provide sewer service. We're a nonprofit utility that provides a most basic and vital function in our community, sewage treatment. The work we do is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We protect public health. We protect our rivers and streams, and we support economic development within our entire region. It's a basic tenet of our business, of what I do, that we need to justify the rates that we charge our customers based on the cost of the services that we provide. With respect to the rights-of-way fees, it's only fair that the cities are transparent about what they charge our customers by accounting for how these fees are being spent. We simply want fairness and equitability from the cities when imposing these fees on their citizens and our ratepayers. I'm not here to argue against the city's home rule authority in imposing these fees, but argue for the basic principles of maintaining the public trust in doing so. These fees are currently based on a percentage of gross revenue collected within the boundaries rather than any calculation of actual costs incurred by these cities. This approach is inconsistent with the fundamental principles of accountability and unnecessarily increase the costs of these basic and essential services for Oregonians. I'll give you an example. Wes owns and operates over 350 miles of pipes and collection system pump stations. However, in the city of Gladstone, we have 755 feet of pipe. It's been in the ground for about 30 years, and it probably will sit there for another 20 before we need to touch it. However, we have to surrender 5% of gross revenues in Gladstone. That's over $40,000 per year. For what? The situation, well, and when you do the math, Gladstone, like Beaverton mentioned, they do charge their own citizens. They own and operate the pipes within the city of Gladstone, except for the large pipe, the 755 feet that we own. They charge 66 cents per linear foot. For us, it's $21 per foot. Per foot. That's not equitable. That's not fair. That's not based on any kind of actual costs or expenses. The situation is even more stark in Oregon City, where we pay over $250,000 per year in fees with no rationale or accountability for how it's being spent. It's important to know that when West does work in city streets, we incur the full cost of bringing those streets back to pristine condition with respect to grading, paving, striping, curbs, sidewalks, etc. The only cost to the cities is in the oversight of our work, permitting, inspection, etc. The city charges us a road opening permit fee and dictates the conditions of these permits to ensure that we leave it in a pristine state. The right-of-way fees imposed by Oregon City, Gladstone, and Happy Valley have a significant impact on our ratepayers, especially those on fixed income, who will not see any difference in their service, just increased costs. Happy Valley residents will see an increase of almost $3 per month on their bills. These charges are onerous, excessive, and not based on any demonstrable costs incurred by the cities. SB 202 requires an objective accounting of these city rights-of-way costs and will ensure our customers are getting the value for their money. Our ratepayers deserve to know what their hard-earned dollars are being paid, are paying for, and these city-imposed right-of-way fees need to be fair, need-based, and justifiable. Thank you.
Presuming there's no questions there, Chair Haas, Vice Chair Boquist, members of the committee, my name is Chris Story, and I have worked with and on behalf of West and the Tri-City Service District for the last 10 years as an attorney. I'm here to urge you to vote in support of Senate Bill 202 and or Senate Bill 840 with respect to the clarification that municipal entities should not have to pay a tax to serve city residents. As noted in Director Guy's testimony, this issue has manifested itself in Clackamas County. We're sort of the heart of the issue right now, unfortunately. The right-of-way charges that have been imposed first by Oregon City and then rippling out to other cities generated remarkable profits from a fellow municipal entity, and it's something that we've seen other cities look at as revenue that they need to support their general funds. It's spreading. This issue has been so negatively impactful to our ratepayers that the Board of County Commissioners authorized litigation against one of our member cities, which they did not do lightly, to try and get clarification that a city should not impose a tax on a fellow municipal entity. That case is ripe. It's going to be litigated actually next week. And you've already heard two attorneys talk about the cases, so I won't bore you with a third opinion. I'll just say that we've tried consensus, we've tried negotiations, we tried the conversations, and the answer we heard was pay up. And we think that our ratepayers deserve a better answer than it is what it is. Cities are allowed to impose a tax on private entities, and we don't object to that at all, and I won't get into the rationale of what percentage is the right one. We do object, however, to fellow municipal entities that are providing crucial public services to the same citizens being asked to fund general funds of cities. We've seen that category dragging in water districts, sewer districts, and in our instance in Clackamas County, even technology, where we've put in broadband to try and provide internet access to unincorporated residents that passes through cities, and we're seeing attacks on that as we try to expand internet infrastructure to underserved areas. We know, for example, the $250,000 that West contributes to the City of Oregon City is part of $6.7 million in right-of-way fees that they receive over their biannual budget. We would suggest that perhaps municipal entities aren't necessary to subsidize that level of profit. In written testimony submitted by to the committee by various cities, they have advanced the argument that they can charge a fee, to which we agree, but they have not articulated the actual costs, and there seems to be a challenge or refusal to articulate what those actual costs would be, and indeed there's quite the emphasis on how this is the second largest revenue source for the cities. If you're looking for a revenue source, you should not be looking at your fellow government entities. A private utility can pay, a public service provider should not. We've tried to make that distinction, we've tried to have that conversation, and the answer is no, you'll pay the same, we want our pound of flesh. However, this form of municipal cannibalism is the very opposite of good government policy. The exemption of municipal entities from being taxed by one another is a foundational policy in Oregon and is designed to avoid this very sort of situation. As the U.S. Supreme Court has stated, the power to tax is the power to destroy, and we don't want government entities destroying each other.
Cities in these tough economic times are now seeing their partners that provide crucial civic services, such as wastewater, drinking water, as new revenue sources. This approach is new, I would like to emphasize. Our sewer district has had lines in these cities for 30 years. Only now, within the last few, have they started to see right-of-way charges as reasonable against their fellow municipal entities. Previously, we were just a partner helping to provide the service that they needed. We hope that this will not continue. The City of Oregon City, in imposing their tax, asked for us to charge the fee not to their residents, but to every resident of the district, including residents of Gladstone and the City of West Lynn. We've seen similar requests from other cities, as they call it a cost of doing business, which means you're now seeing the opportunity of cities versus cities for right-of-way charges, because they want not their residents, but everybody to pay. It creates a race of who can have the highest right-of-way fee so you can extract the most money into the general fund. You could have residents of Happy Valley paying a small share for the Happy Valley right-of-way fee, while residents in the City of Milwaukee have to pay for that share of the charge imposed by Happy Valley. We don't want to see that internecine warfare between our partner jurisdictions. We think this bill is a great way to clarify the role and make it clear that we will pay our fair share, we'll pay the actual costs, but we don't want to be a profit center. On behalf of Clackamas County and her service districts, we urge this committee to recognize that tough times do not justify bad policy and clarify once and for all that cities should not view their fellow municipal partners and their ratepayers as a piggy bank to be exploited when times are tough. We will happily pay our fair share for the actual cost of using the city right-of-way, and our citizens will happily contribute to that actual cost. We ask for an articulation of that cost, and we'll show up with a check. Senate Bill 202 and or Senate Bill 840 with respect to the government provisions would allow that to happen, and therefore we urge your support for it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions of this panel? Thank you both.
Thank you.
All right. Mark Gamba, Lori Drever, Brad Nanke. Apologize for those pronunciations from Milwaukee and Happy Valley. Perhaps you can rebut some of those previous mentions that involve Milwaukee and Happy Valley.
Go ahead. Right.
Good morning, Chair Haas, Vice Chair Boquist, members of the committee. I'm Lori Dreamer, the mayor of Happy Valley. And so we take testimony all the time. There's nothing more ingratiating than repeating. So I'll skip what has been, we've submitted a letter on behalf that has all those points.
Hear that?
Yeah.
She's going to talk for 5 minutes.
No, I won't talk for 5 minutes, I promise. I just want to highlight some of the Happy Valley comments that were made and maybe. So the priorities, you know, being good stewards of the taxpayer dollars, and as Senator Boquist, Vice Chair Boquist mentioned, 5 and 50 comes into play. It is what we have, right? I mean, that's not a secret. But streamlining or aligning our pockets is kind of unfortunate to say. At 67 cents per thousand, one of the lowest tax rates in the state, you've got to come up with the money from somewhere. And if we don't get the reasonable payback for what it costs in order to do business with our public utilities, we have to backfill that with our general fund. Either way, the cost of doing business is expensive for everybody, including our citizens. And I think some of the things over 52 years in the city, we've dealt with our right-of-way. And so some examples in particular to Happy Valley, we just worked with our private utility, as well as Clackamas County, Sunrise Water Authority, to streamline those guidelines. Regardless of whether or not it's public or private. So for Clackamas County, Sunrise Water, this meant being charged for the right-of-way use for the very first time. Well, the city of Happy Valley is growing at a high rate in the last 10 years, but we've not torn up our roads most recently, so we've never charged for those right-of-way fees before, but it does cost. Now, it doesn't make sense for a mayor or a city council to take advantage of those citizens, because they're the ones who are going to come talk to us and say, what are you doing? Because we know it's a pass-through cost. So if we charge our public utilities, they will pass it down to the consumer, who will then come and say, you know, this is too expensive. So we have to make sure that we're not doing that as well. But the costs still have to be done. So when we're tearing up these roads or any other utility, we've got to pay for it somehow. And it is a lease payment or a rent payment to the city. And then when it was talked about, again, lining our pockets, well, it's been well known in the city of Happy Valley that we're not here to make a profit off of our citizens or anybody else doing business when it comes to fees. So we want to make sure they're commensurate with the cost, the actual cost. And I think that's exactly what the county was referring to. And $3, I think, added to the city of Happy Valley residents, well, that's the cost of doing business for the citizens. So we have to make sure that there's a balance to that. I don't know how else to say it. I mean, if we've got a $55 million budget, but only, you know, 15 of it is general fund, and we're tearing up our roads nonstop, we have to make sure that we can continue to grow and do business. So in closing, home rule, we've been doing good with these utilities. I'm not sure that there's an argument or a disagreement with Happy Valley. We just have to work through it locally. And I think that that's the question. And sometimes we come to you and we're saying, fix it locally, stay out of it locally. And I think that that's just an unfortunate thing that we have to come to the state sometimes. But I think this is something, home rule, that we have to respect and let us do the business that we want to do locally and work with these entities. So again, in closing, I've submitted the letter in detail for you all to read, and I just want you to know that I'm here on behalf of the mayor of Happy Valley, the mayor's consortium in the Portland metropolitan area, and I am also on the League of Oregon Cities board. So thank you for having me.
Thank you. Chair Hass, Vice Chair Boquist, members of the committee, my name is Brad Nanke. I'm a Salem City Councilor, immediate past president of the League of Oregon Cities, and also president of the Mid-Willamette Valley Cable Regulatory Commission, similar to Mayor DeRemer. I'll submit my testimony as well and just touch on a couple of the pieces. City of Salem is, in fact, opposed to both Senate Bill 202 and 840. We believe that the agreements between cities and other government agencies should be dealt with at the local level. We have a long history of that. We actually negotiated an agreement with State of Oregon for the state's own Salem Metropolitan Area Network. And for over 13 years, we've enjoyed mutually beneficial outcomes of that. We're also currently negotiating an agreement with the Salem-Keizer School District that would connect 65 school administrative buildings. We actually charge ourselves a franchise fee as well for water sewer. Originally, I was wondering why we would charge our own citizens who've paid for that utility another fee on top of it. But it's not just City of Salem residents, City of Keizer, City of Turner. And it could be run by another utility rather than the city as well. So we view it as a right-of-way fee that should be charged to ourselves and our residents as well. As other entities have spoken to in regards to, general fund revenues in and of themselves, our property taxes only cover 52% of our general fund, and that doesn't even cover our police and fire. So I know the committee is dealing with other issues as well regarding revenues and taxation. So with that, I would just pass along that the City of Salem is opposed to these two, and we look forward to the work of the committee.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Hass, Vice Chair Boquist, committee members. I'm Mark Gamba. I'm the mayor of Milwaukee. I'm also here this morning representing the Metro Mayors Consortium. There are people much smarter than me that are going to talk to you about the legal ins and outs of this. What I would like to do is sort of give you a sense of why it might be difficult in the case of 202 to prescribe a precise amount in the moment that another public utility is coming in to do some work. You can, of course, figure out the fees to have someone to come in, mark where the other utilities are. You can figure out what it costs you to have somebody there inspect the job, all of those kinds of things. And, of course, there's the cost of patching the street. What you can't calculate in that moment is that 5 years down the road, that spot where you patched that street is now a pothole. And that wouldn't have been a pothole had there not been a patch. So you're now in the place of having to replace that street eventually. You get enough of those patches and enough of those potholes. And that's a substantially higher cost to the city. Another example is sidewalks. So PGE has several poles on our sidewalks, right? Many of the sidewalks, at least in my city, when they were built, were 3 and 4 foot wide sidewalks. Well, the federal ADA Act requires a much wider space for wheelchairs now to pass along a sidewalk. And so we're now going back out and, at the cost of our citizens, replacing sidewalks because there's a pole in the way. Those are not costs that in the moment you can ascertain to say, well, we know that in 5 years or in 10 years, we're going to have to spend a really large amount of money to fix a problem that you're creating for us right now. The cities are well aware that every charge that we make on other utilities is passed back down to our citizens. And we don't want to make that any higher than we absolutely have to. Over the period of years, we've been able to determine, all right, ballpark, this is roughly what it's costing us to have these utilities in our rights of way. And so this is what we need to charge. We don't, in the city of Milwaukee, currently charge any public entities outside of our own utilities. So the only one that I believe that's in our rights of way is Clackamas County with their fiber. We have an agreement with them. We worked out a reasonable agreement between us in an MOU. We don't charge them rights of way fee. I think 202 is a solution to people not getting along. I think reasonable people can sort out problems at the local level where we know what the local issues are. And I think it's an overreach of the state to try and dictate what those outcomes should be. In the case of 840, it's much worse. You've got companies for profit that are using our public rights of way, the publicly owned lands, in essence to profit, and are asking at this point to pay less to do so, even though our costs for continuing to maintain those rights of way are high. Senator Boquist, you're absolutely right. I think there'd be a whole lot less squabbling going wrong if 5 and 50 were solved, but that is our current reality, and we have to live within the fact that all of our costs of running a city are increasing at a rate far higher than the property taxes are. So, indeed, every form of income that we can find to fix, to keep our cities functioning at some kind of nominal level is important to us. So the City of Milwaukee and the Metro Mayors Consortium would respectfully request that you take no action on either of these bills. Thank you.
Questions for this panel? Mayors, Councilman, thank you.
Thank you.
Werner Seaman, Ted Case, Gary Bauer. From the utilities.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Werner Seaman, representing Portland General Electric. I'm here today to testify and support, actually, just of one concept that's in Senate Bill 840, which is the ceiling in terms of the amount of taxes and fees that a city could charge in terms of imposing on utility customers for the use of the right-of-way. First, I just want to state that although some of the testimony before has been somewhat pointed, I want to just first state for PGE's perspective, we very much value the relationship that we have with the cities. We think that they're important partners of us. We appreciate the ability to use the right-of-way, and we think that there's an ongoing and many decades-old partnership in terms of managing the right-of-way. What we want to talk about here is that since the Gresham case, the Gresham v. Portland General Electric, Northwest Natural and Rockwood, dating back to about 1934, there was a cap of 5% that could be levied on the use of the right-of-way that could be charged to Portland General Electric, just speaking of our perspective. What happened in that case is essentially there's no longer a cap on the use of the right-of-way, and we think that at this point, without a cap in terms of what can be charged for our use of the right-of-way, that there is no upper bound, so says the Oregon Supreme Court. Keep in mind, these are taxes that the way that they're calculated for us is it's on the gross receipts that we collect from the jurisdiction in question. So in the case of Gresham, the percentage is right now we're charged 7% of the gross receipts for all sales in the city of Gresham, excluding certain factors that aren't built into that base. We actually believe, contrary to some of the testimony that was just given, that in that case and in my conversations with the city of Gresham, that this isn't a nexus in terms of the cost to manage the right-of-way or to manage that interaction. We've actually seen that we've moved away from that nexus in terms of what the cap is, and that we're starting to move very much into the area that this is general fund revenue. I think that the relevant case, and we're very sympathetic in the city of Gresham, we understand that they have significant challenges in collecting revenue. We don't disagree with that at all. What we saw in that case was that the city had a challenge in paying for fire protection, which we're absolutely sympathetic to. I think that there's a question of how do you raise that revenue. Going back to about 1934, the legislature had in place a cap. Since the Gresham decision in the Supreme Court, there's no longer a cap on that. We think that as we talk about gross receipts taxes, certainly that was conversation last year with ballot measure 97 around gross receipts taxes, talking about 2.5%. We think that utility taxes and utility customers' obligations around gross receipts taxes was part of that conversation last fall. We understand this committee and the House committee is looking at business tax reform overall this session. That's conversation that's taking place. And I think that as we're having that conversation, we think that it's valid to talk about what the overall tax obligation could be on a utility. And right now we have cities that are charging up to 7%. There's nothing that would prohibit a city going to, say, 15%, 20% charging on gross receipts within that jurisdiction. So we think that it's timely during this legislative session to have a conversation around whether or not it makes sense to reinstate a cap for what can be charged for the use of the right-of-way. And again, we very much appreciate the work that cities do. We appreciate those partnerships. We don't want to be anti-city in any stretch. We just think that with the recent court case, it's introduced some significant uncertainty. And as we talk about total business tax obligations in the state, we think that this is something that's relevant to be considered. Thank you.
Chair House, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ted Case. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association. We represent 18 not-for-profit electric utilities in the state of Oregon, serving some of the most remote and rural parts of the state. Here today in support of Senate Bill 840, because of our rural nature, we don't serve a lot of cities, but we do have one of my members, Oregon Trail Electric Co-op, that serves 21 cities out in eastern Oregon. And they've seen recently a proposal from the city of LeGrand to increase the franchise fee by 40%. We don't think that that is reasonable. We don't think that's appropriate. We think that's an overreach. So we recognize that cities are financially stressed. We've heard some of that testimony today. But we think that shoring up their budgets through the use of our co-op members is not the way to solve their budget woes. We feel it's our job to protect our members from higher rate increases. We're the only person that able to do that. So if this goes unchecked, and we think that Senate Bill 840 will help check that, it has potential to impact economic development, load growth, and siting in some of the areas that that have not served in the economic recovery. So we fully support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Hass, members of the committee. I'm Gary Bauer with Northwest Natural. Just to kind of get a quick background, we serve about 640,000 customers here in Oregon. We've been in business since 1859. We truly value our relationship with the communities that we serve. We wouldn't be in business this long if we didn't. Just to add a little more flavor around the statute, while the statute set up a cap for a privilege tax, the agreement or the perception that utilities and municipalities have worked under since the 30s was that we could also negotiate a binding agreement outside of that could go higher than the 5%. What's happened is a number of cities have decided to kind of move away from franchise agreements, I think has been mentioned already, and by ordinance start establishing the regulatory process and the fee. And that was the situation in Gresham. And as Mr. Seaman mentioned, there was some discussions that they had with the community trying to raise some revenue to cover certain costs. I know they needed to cover those costs. The voters turned that down, and they then moved over to the utility side. To briefly, just a couple other quick comments. Again, we believe the right-of-way has a value. We've always believed that. We have worked hard at working with the communities. Northwest Natural paid over $27 million in franchise-related fees, so both under a privilege tax or a franchise agreement, to the communities we served last year. In addition, we also pay fees related to work in those right-of-ways. So we recognize they need additional revenue. We understand that. We've been supportive of some of the municipal efforts to raise revenues, but we are concerned that without some level of a cap, that costs could continue to get shifted over to utility customers. So our concern really is in the bill is really about reestablishing a cap. We've had conversations with some communities and cities about this. They've expressed an interest in that discussion, and we would look forward to having that discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the utilities?
I have a question to staff to come back later.
Senator Boquist.
Could you do a follow-up for later clarification? I mean, after a decade, I actually heard something new I'd not heard before here. I'm curious if you could reach out to the PUC on the regulated utilities, because if you have, what I want to know is if one city is paying 7% gross, I never heard of this gross receipts sort of thing, and I don't want the testifier to do it, and another one's paying 3% and so on and so forth, and one entity is paying $27 million, unless I'm mistaken. But if you could check, Kyle, I believe that then goes into the rate-setting measure, and so the rest of the cities and the rest of the customers across the board are subsidizing these cities, I do believe, or whatever it is doing. If you could check on that, I would appreciate that. Thank you.
Mr. Bauer,
yes.
Comment on that?
Chair Hass.
I was giving you an exit strategy.
Senator Boquist. Well, no, I'd be happy to answer that. For natural gas utilities, the first 3%, so if there's five, that 3% goes into rates and is charged to all customers. Anything above that is charged back to the customer, so it's an on-the-bill charge to customers within that jurisdiction. I think for Portland, the electric utilities is 3.5%.
Wow. It's indirect taxation after they failed at their own ballot. Oh, okay. Never heard of that before. Thank you.
Thank you. We've reached the end of our a lot of time here, and I know there are some people who would like to be heard on this, and so this is not the end of this. I try to be very careful today, and we had the same number of people presenting in support of the bill as opposing it, but we've just run out of time. And so this is an issue that we'll continue to consider, and I know there's a legal proceedings coming up, and we'll all be tuning in. Tomorrow, committee, special time, 9:15. Okay? After our thing. We are adjourned. We are adjourned.